ॐ नानव्याख्या प्रकटित परब्रह्म तत्त्वं युवानम् वारुषिशान्ते वसद्वृषिगणैरावृतं ब्रह्मनिष्ठैः आचार्येन्द्रं करकलितचिन्मुद्रमानन्दमूर्तिं स्वात्मा रामं मुदितवदनं दक्षिणामूर्तिमीरे. Repeat after me. Seven. Balyadishwapi jagradadishu. Balyadishwapi jagradadishu. Tata sarvasvavastasvapi. Tata sarvasvavastasvapi. Vyavrittasvanuvartamanam. Vyavrittasvanuvartamanam. Aham nityantaspurantam sada. Aham nityantas. I didn't do it right. Aham nityantaspurantam sada. Aham ityantaspurantam sada. Swatmanam prakriti karoti bhajatam. Swatmanam prakriti karoti bhajatam. Yo mudraya bhadraya. Yo mudraya bhadraya. Tas together. Tasmai Shri Guru Murtaye Nama Idam Shri Dakshina Murtaye. Sandhi. Balya Adishu Api Jagrat Adishu Tata Saravasu Avastasu Api Vyavritasu anuvartamanam aham iti antaspurantam sada swatmanam prakriti karoti bhajatam yo mudraya bhadraya tasmai shri gurumurtiye nama idam shri dakshina murtiye. So balya is childhood, infancy, and child is young. So all of these different ages, these stages of life in terms of the age, being a child, being a teenager, being an adult, being elderly, all of the different stages of life, all of these are called avastas, balyadi avasta, all of these states, all of these stages of life. So ishu, so beginning with childhood. Adi means beginning. So you say balya adi, beginning with childhood. So childhood and on up. And then jagrat adi. This is another, these are a different type of avastas, states of experience. It would be jagrat is the waking state. So then we would have the dream state, swapna, and then the deep sleep state also. Okay, so the waking, dream, and deep sleep, jagrat, etc., the waking state, etc. Tata, and similarly, sarvasu avastasu api. And similarly, in all of the states of experience, whether you're looking waking, dream, deep sleep, the changing vrittis, each vritti is a state of experience. The ages that you go through, these phases that you go through as you go from babyhood to being elderly, from birth to death, there's many avastas, states of experiences that you go through. So, in all of them, in childhood, in beginning with childhood, in these states of experience, or waking, or similarly waking, dream, deep sleep, those states of experience, which are kind of, when you say the adi, it's pointing out a grouping that you're familiar with. Then it says, in fact, in all of the avastas, in every state of experience, even down to very tiny ones, like a vritti, Avritti is replaced by avritti. So here it says, Vyavritasu, second line, Vyavritasu, in all of the avastas, which are coming and going, which are changing, the Vyavrita means they're being replaced. They're changing, they're coming and going. So in all of these avastas where one replaces the other, so in all of these states of experience, which are continually changing, then anuvartamanam aham, the I is, remember when I was using in the last class this word anuvritti? Anuvritti means that which is continuing. In every state of experience, that which runs through, sometimes they use for anuvritti, it's kind of like if you have a necklace, there's a thread running through the necklace. And so whatever bead is there, it has the same thread. That's the idea. It's just a drishtanta. Because the anuvritti would be the thread that's running through every bead. And for us, the anuvritti is just the conscious being, the me that is present in every avasta. Avasta meaning the tiniest state of experience or the biggest state of experience that we can have, longest state of experience, and all different kinds of states of experience. Any experience where rather slow, changing experiences like going from childhood to the teenage years, etc., that's a slower changing avasta. Or you can look at it day by day by day. You know, this day is different from this day is different from this day, but I'm the self in every one of them. This is the anuvritti, or the anuvartamanam. It's a present participle. It means this aham is there, is there being experienced as the self. The self is there in every state of experience, in every vritti, in every waking dream deep sleep state, or even longer, waking dream deep sleep, which is a 24-hour day, you know, or the states of experience you have that are longer lasting, that take you through your whole life. So that's what we mean by the avasta. The anuvartamanam aham, this I, is there through all of those states of experience, never changing, never coming and going, but what we call the very adhisthana, the very self, the very being in which all of these states of experiences are taking place. So now it says, this aham, which is antaspurantam, which is, antaspurantam means, it's another present participle, it means, which is shining inside. Inside of what? Inside of the body. The conscious being, from the standpoint of the body, mind, sense organs, is innermost. So that which is shining inside, inside the body, inside all of these states of experience, which exist in the jiva upadhi, right? It's not like the childhood belongs to this body. The waking dream deep sleep really belongs to the sukshma sharira that's going through all of these changes of waking and dream and deep sleep. Each is vyavrita, each negates and is replaced by the other. So it says this, just for you know, some of you are making vocabulary lists. Anuvritti and anuvartamanam is an important word in the Vedanta. Antaspurantam, shining inside. And then sada means it's indeclinable, it's always. So this aham is always shining inside as an anuvritti. Means no matter what the experience, that self is there. Right? No matter which beat it is, the string is there. Whatever experience is there on whatever level, the atma is there inside, innermost, as the very luminary, the very me that lights up that experience. Okay? So spurantam sada means always. Then swatmanam prakriti karoti iti karoti bhajatam yomudraya bhadraya. So then he says, swatmanam, one's own self, prakriti karoti, is made manifest, makes known, causes it to be recognized. Bhajatam, to who? For his devotees, for his sishas, for his students. Yaha, he who? The one who, prakriti karoti, makes known, makes manifest in the sense of something that the buddhi now recognizes, becomes aware of, so it becomes sakshat. Sakshat, I could as well say here, sakshat karoti. The self, which has been totally superimposed on all of your experiences, all of those avastas, is shining in its own right fully, completely. It's not as though these avastas or these states of experiences are covering it in like a bag, putting a bag over something. It's not covering it. But the supram, the ajnanam, the recognition of my own being not being there, the mind, body, sense organs, so the mind has the sattva, so the mind identified with the body and identified with all of the sense organs, superimposes me upon it. Right? It's not the self is not doing anything. Your self is free, you are as you are. Nothing has ever happened. There is no bondage or moksha for the Atma. The bondage, the liberation, the bondage and liberation is only for the mind. It's for the jiva. The jiva tvam, in fact, being a jiva, is simply a product of ignorance. There is no jiva, really. The jiva is completely mithya. There is not a little small self turning around or a little conscious. The jiva has a little consciousness. Consciousness is not objectifiable. There's no little or big consciousness, right? But there's those things which reflect consciousness like a mirror, and those things are continually changing. And so since they're continually changing, but always, but I'm as though abiding in them, like the sun is abiding in the water, in that reflected in the water, I'm always like abiding in that from the standpoint of the upadhi. And so that little self is as though there, you know. But your experience is not of a little self. If I hold my face up to the mirror is not experiencing me, it's experiencing Namarupa. Now, if I hold my face up to the mirror, the self-experience that I'm having is not in the mirror. It's in me. You see, that's really important. Let's say you hold up a thought which reflects consciousness. So you're holding up this thought which as though reflects me. Where is the me experience? It's in me. I am the experience, not the reflection. You know, the reflection on the part of the buddhi allows the buddhi to recognize its own mityatva. When I'm doing this strict drisha viveka, or I'm trying to sit with the experience of that, of the one that is an anuvritti, the one in all of the experiences, an anuvritti means my being is always there in exactly the same way. I have to then, in doing these kind of prakriyas, I have to notice that the one who is always there, always the same, you know, has to be different from the things that are coming and going. Right? If I remain and it goes, then I'm not that. Just like in the world, you know, whatever goes, just in terms of the physical body, if you all walk out the door, well, this physical body isn't walking out the door, you know, and so you're not attached to me because you can come and go. And nothing happens to my body. It's not being dragged along. That's simple. That subject-object relationship in reference to the world is very, very simple. You know? If I can take off my clothes are not part of my skin. You know? They're different. They're what we call asanga. There's no attachment. There's no connection. So what about with consciousness, with the me? When all of these vrittis, or all of these avastas, all of these states of experience come and go, totally negating each other, wiping each other out, replacing each other. They replace each other totally and completely, but I am still there. That anuvritti is something that I can recognize. It just simply needs to be pointed out. Otherwise, we don't think about it, because the mind is fully experiencing itself as a conscious being. So it has no reason to do that viveka, because its experience is of me, the conscious being. Mind, if that's always true, wherever the mind is, consciousness is, then why shouldn't it say, I am consciousness, I am the conscious being? So then we have to look at, well, you know, it looks like there's a real superimposition going on here, because everything that you, the consciousness you take to be yourself, doesn't go when you go. It doesn't go when you go. It's there illumining the next vritti and the next vritti. It's there illumining the waking state, and the whole waking world goes and comes to the dream state. You're still there. You haven't been touched in any way. And so there's a self, this me, This is not just a philosophy. It's me. We're talking about me, the conscious being that you recognize as me. But the only problem is you recognize me, and that's Brahman. That is yourself. And that self never comes and goes. All that comes and goes are the experiences, but because the experiences that are sattva, that reflect consciousness, are always enjoying consciousness, why shouldn't they just assume that I am the conscious being? It makes sense that that ignorance is kind of inbuilt into the creation from the standpoint of those that are limited beings within the creation. For Ishvara, there's no problem, because being the whole, there's nothing in particular you're identified with. Right, so the whole, like if you have an imagination or a dream and you're not identified with anything in it, then you're the sakshi of the whole dream. That's no problem. The dream is just what the dream is. But there's no one inside of the dream experiencing it. Subject to birth and death and the being impacted by all of the objects in the dreams not happening. So Ishvara has it a little better. In the Shastra it says that Ishvara has it a lot much better. It's in the Brahma Sutras. The only problem is sometimes what's happening in the world is very painful for the jivas. And so he experiences that he recognizes, experiences that pain. Just like if you watch a movie. That movie, you know, others are suffering in the movie. You're not suffering, or you watch the news. Imagine that, and that the news is not... But it's not personal to you. It's personal in a way, but not personal to you. You have a relationship with it because it's being experienced, that's all. So with Ishvara, there's nothing but the Sat-Chit-Atma there, but whatever is going on in the whole manifest creation, infinite creation, is known. So there's a lesha of dukkha. Lesha means there's a recognition of dukkha, as opposed to no recognition. From Brahman standpoint of just the self, there's no recognition of sukha or dukkha that belongs to the creation. But from the standpoint of the creation, it exists there, and so it's recognized. See what I mean? So the one who brings about through these prakriyas that are being used, that recognition of an ever-present self that is not coming and going, the one who makes that known to his, they say devotees. Now that's also an important word. The sisha, or the student, of any teacher, it doesn't matter. If that teacher is your teacher, for that person to really be your teacher, even if you're taking a geometry class, you have to have a certain shraddha and respect or a recognition inside that teacher actually knows what he or she is talking about, and that you want to learn from that teacher. If you don't have that, it's what we call shraddha. If you don't have that shraddha, then your body is there and your mind is elsewhere. You know, I used to have classes like that when I was becoming a psychologist, and I had to go to night school, and I was tired. I worked all day, and I was really tired. And if the teacher was somebody that I could kind of relate to, and also was able to kind of teach with some clarity, in my opinion, then I could be present in the class and get something. But on a couple of occasions, I didn't have that shraddha. I didn't like being there. I didn't want to be there. I felt like I was doing time. That's exactly what it felt like. It was like I was ticking time, and the class was a 3-hour class. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a long class. And so what I used to do, and no, this is not very nice, but this is what I used to do. We'd get a little 15-minute break in the class, and I would extend it to it took me half an hour to go back, because I was tired and I didn't want to be there and I could not listen. So say the teacher that you're listening to for Vedanta, it can extend to any subject, but especially in Vedanta, if that person doesn't not functioning as your teacher, it's just a waste of time. You know, because the mind has to be available. It's very subtle. This is what's being taught. It's like your mind has to kind of be relaxed and being able to kind of turn toward the vision that's being unfolded. It has to be available for that. And so when we say Shraddha or devotion or any of these things, it's not some gooey thing. Yeah. It's a practical thing that you are able in this particular setting, whatever it may be, to gain this knowledge. And that's not a given. You know, it's just like in therapy also, when a person, I talked about this a little before, but if my clients, would sometimes want me to recommend their partner or somebody to a therapist, and I would give two or three recommendations, but then I would always say, you know, when you go, there has to be something inside that wants to do that work with that person. It's just how it is. And that's not a given. So if you don't feel that, then get what you can get, but I would move on. I would definitely move on. So that, and Bhagavan will move you on anyway. Because if you're a mumukshu, there is some pathway that will get you to the teacher who will work for you, will work with you, work for whom this knowledge between the two of you will take place. Because that mumukshutvam is there, and so sometimes a teacher or even another student or somebody is a catalyst to get you to where you belong. When you get to where you belong, you find that your mind is available. That's really what it is. Your mind is, at the time of teaching, your mind is available. It's not after or before. During the time of teaching, your mind is available to see. You can't take any of that for granted, you know. Your mind can be, it could be like this. Your mind is really available. That connection is there. But you have issues. I used to have that. Swamiji is definitely my teacher. There's no forever, you know. It's such a beautiful thing. But there were definitely times when my mind wasn't available. Something had hurt my feelings, or some stuff was coming up, or, you know. But there was plenty of those instances, but it was never because he wasn't my teacher. It was because there were issues. There were blocks. Or maybe I was even angry at him, or maybe he hurt my feelings. Those are all blocks. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about there has to be an open, the heart. It's not just your mind, your heart has to be available so that you can relax and really see. Because the teaching itself, it's a pramana, it's a means of knowledge. For any means of knowledge, it's a means of knowledge for the direct, immediate differentiation and recognition of the self that you are. You're already completely here. So you need to, the mind has the ignorance, and that has to be recognized. The mind is the one that has the problem, not your being. If your being has the problem, then there is really no moksha. There's just trying to live a dharmic life and do the best you can and have, you know, relative shanti because of your values and the way that you treat others and even some shraddha that there's something greater than yourself running the show. Mm-hmm. You're here, but there's something else also, mm-hmm. which contains you, you know. Then you have relative shanti, which is also good, but it's not moksha. It's not moksha. Because you can't relax. You can't fully relax and just say, all is well with me, no matter what happens, whether the universe is here or not here, you know, or whether I make this mistake or that mistake. Nothing happens to me. Even Ishwar can't do anything. The Lord can't do anything to me. Because I am his self also, or her self also, you know. Different order of reality. So once I discover myself as that timeless, changeless reality, and it is the very ananda or fullness that I could ever want, much more than actually I can ever even think to accomplish, to gain from the world, because the world is fraught with peril. All of my anandas, all of my little joys, they're fraught with peril because too many things can happen to take that away. But that can't happen with yourself. And the joy or ananda we talk about with the self, with the atma, is not happy. I don't feel happy right now or I'm not having a bliss experience, that's not the ananda that we're talking about. We're talking about that which is the most dear. That which is the most dear and is there present, fully present in every experience that you have. The vrittis are of all different types. All different types of, from subtle to gross, from, you know, agitated to shanti, whatever they happen to be, they are what they are. But yourself is the most dear, and it is exactly the same in every single vritti. It's not covered at all. Once that viveka, that discrimination, takes place. And so this is why going through these avastas, we did in the last verse, waking, dream, and deep sleep, but now looking at the avastas, the different states of experience in the waking state, you know, and seeing all of these levels of experience, all of these things that change, they come and go and you don't. Who is the one that doesn't go? Because the one that doesn't go is here, self-evident, not changing. So there's a wonderful opportunity to be able to discriminate the me, you know. And you don't, it's not a discrimination that takes place through looking. Let's look for it. That's very frustrating. Because I look inside in this direction or this direction, I'm looking this direction. But the one who is the very changeless self-shining me is not an object. It's not an internal object. It's not an external object. It's the very center, which is my own self. So sometimes when we do a meditation, we'll say something like, let you relax, invoke the inner friend, you know, turn your buddhi, you know, just gently toward your own being, toward the self. It's so fun. We still have the buddhi turned, though, toward the self. That's beautiful. It's doing a viveka with itself, a discrimination between itself and the self when it does that. But there's this other subtle little thing you can do from that point. We say, just be yourself. So the ahankara goes from the buddhi turned toward the self to just being yourself, where you recognize that you are not an object, subject, you are not having a subject-object relationship with the buddhi when it turns toward yourself. Actually, you are the self that is lighting up the buddhi, the consciousness which the buddhi is enjoying, the buddhi having no independent existence at all. And so all that happens there is actually nothing's changing. The buddhi is just focused on you, and so there's no other objects taking place. But because of the, but still there can be, there's kind of a subject object that can be there, even though there isn't. I don't know if I had to explain it, but if I say just be yourself, all of a sudden you are you and the buddhi is the buddhi, you know, and the experiences are the experiences, and you recognize this is me. There's no subject object there. It's just I as consciousness and self-luminous. That's who I am. So you can, it's a little mental twist. But it's important, because what happens is you start the ahankara, instead of always kind of sneakingly coming from the standpoint of the body or the mind or the sense organs or whatever, the ahankara is mitya, becomes very much mitya. And the aham becomes me. So the ahankara is mitya, and then the aham, my sense of self, my sense of being, whatever words like that, or this is who I am, is always only me. This the conscious being, the me that I am, who is always exactly the same. The vrittis are the vrittis, the emotions are the emotions, the body is the body, all of them reflect me, but I am the me. So the ahankara is always, the aham is always landing on my own self. And then, because I have a mind, body, sense organs, and the body reflects me, I can say, I am going to the store, because from the standpoint of the body, it enjoys consciousness. It reflects consciousness because of the sukshma sharira. So this conscious body, this conscious mind is thinking. It's really only able to think because of myself that illumines it and is such it, but conscious being. But as long as the mind has that, it is able to think. The body is able to walk, you know, and function. All of these things. The sense organs are able to work. So from the standpoint of the sense organs, I can say, you know, oh, I see that, or I hear that, or I'm taking a walk, you know, or I'm thinking about this, or I have a lot of feelings around this. That's all ahankar, but it's totally mitya. It's totally mitya, but it's a practical mitya. The body, mind, sense organs are mitya. And the aham, the consciousness reflected in those body, mind, sense organs, doesn't go away when you get knowledge. There's a subtle body. The sense of touch pervades the whole body. And so it enjoys consciousness. And so from the standpoint of mitya, from the standpoint of the world, I can say, I am doing this, I am doing that, I'm thinking this, I'm thinking that, I'm feeling this. You know, I'm tired, or I feel a lot of energy. See what I mean? It's natural for you to say that, but that doesn't mean you've become the body, mind, sense organs. The aham, who you are, is very clear. It's the conscious being that you are, who is has an anuvritti, as that anuvritti is present in exactly the same way, without any change, for every experience that you have. That viveka needs to be there. And because your being does not exist within as an object within time and space, but is of a different order of reality, non-objectifiable existence being itself. It's timeless, changeless. It doesn't go through the same changes, continual changing, that anything that exists within time and space does. But also, you not being subject to time and space, they're both objectifiable, they're withdrawn in deep sleep, the whole universe is, or in samadhi, they're totally withdrawn. Your being not an object in time or space, can only be one. No space, I am free of space, how many of me can there be? I am free of space, free of any type of objectivity, where is there going to be time? There's no change. There has to be time and space. There has to be objectivity and differentiation. For there to be time, we have to be able to mark time. You see that? The self that is not subject to space can't have any duality from its own standpoint. It can't have any duality. Like it can't have a right side and a left side, because that takes up space then. In space, you can have a right side and a left side. You can have an up and a down. You can have the front and the back and all. You need space for that. That which is free of space and yet is non-dual. Non-dual doesn't require space. There's nothing else. There is no other thing. So if you think of recognize your own being, how many of us are there? What would make my being different than you? You have to come into space. For that. Now, if you come into space, you can say, well, my body is different from yours. And yes, okay. My sense organs are different from yours. Yes. My mind is different from yours. My thoughts are different from yours. My intelligence level is different from your intelligence level. My prana is different from your prana. Yeah, absolutely. These are all upadis within time and space. We already know that, though. I mean, what if that was the teaching? Your body is different than your body. What am I supposed to learn there? What's the message? Mm. You know? But to recognize that yourself is only one is what has to be recognized. And all these prakriyas go toward that recognition. So now, though, just think about it. If you understand through the prakriyas, these methodologies, that yourself is only one and it cannot be otherwise, then in terms of this time-space creation, where is that self not? Where is it? Where is it not? That becomes very interesting. It illumines me, it illumines you, it illumines you, but maybe it illumines and is the self of the entire creation. Just like the self, yourself is the self of the entire dream. You see, yes, it's the self of the entire imagination. Yes, that's clear. But what if we say, in the same way, it's this me, it's not only the self of all beings, like you, 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 me, it's the self of the entire creation. That's Ishvara. Ishvara is my non-dual self with this Maya, what we call Maya, which is responsible for the manifestation of the whole, kind of like the manifestation of your imagination, or the manifestation of your dream, the manifestation of the whole creation, has for its being the Satchit, which is your very self. That's what we call Ishvara. And why would it not be that way? Especially when we look at, then this is where the analysis of the creation comes in terms of Sattva Rajas Tamas and the manifestation of the Sattva Rajas Tamas. If you look at the Sattva Rajas Tamas as the manifestation of the whole creation, then everything is Sattva, everything is Rajas, everything is Tamas. It's when it gets divided into objects and you can say, well, this part is Sattva, like in the body. This is Sattva, it reflects consciousness. The body is just Tamas. The Rajas is responsible for the prana. But what about when you look in terms of the whole creation? And you just recognize this whole creation is known. Think of your dream. We use the dream drishtanta. And so then kind of an understanding. And we talk a lot about Ishvara, but you get more and more clarity of understanding. I think we'll get into that a little bit more, because some shuddha is also involved, shuddha in the shastra, for the complete acceptance of Ishvara. Because there's some logical and experiential jumps that you have to make. They make complete sense, but it's not what we call sakshat. It's not immediate recognition, or the immediate recognition, this recognition of yourself and of the mityatva of this creation is immediate. It's here to be dealt with. But when you make these infinite extensions to Ishvara, and then even to think about the beginningless coming into manifestation, sustaining and going into unmanifest condition, there's a jump there. You don't really know that. You can appreciate it. We have drishtantas for it. It makes sense. But you're not going to have the same type of direct, immediate aproksha jnana of that. For Ishvara, takes some more time to really understand it. So now here, you see what we do. Okay. Here he says, so he who makes manifest, brings to light, makes known, one's own self, swatmanam prakati karoti. He who makes that known, who teaches, makes it recognized, one's own self recognized, to his devotees, to his students, means to those who have that shraddha. And it's not that, this is another important thing about that, it's not like the teacher decides who his students are. The teacher doesn't decide that. It's the students who decide that. The teacher is not, or the guru is a guru to the student from the standpoint of the students, not from the standpoint of the teacher. The teacher doesn't think, oh, well, I'll teach you, 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 and you. It's not that way at all. It's that the students come to the teacher, and those students that for whom the teacher is okay enough to have that shraddha, for you, for each individual person, then that's the one for whom this knowledge, this teaching, does its work. Right? So guru means the one who removes ignorance. The student is the one who knows that. If this person has removed my ignorance. Some students will say, for me it's very clear, who was it that did that for me? That's my guru. Some people say, I first met this person, and that's where I first got my clarity, but I really gained my knowledge from this person. Even for Swamiji, it was like that.
Yeah.
With Swami Chinmayananda, he got a lot, but he didn't get the teaching methodology. And so there are still a lot of problems, a lot of things that hadn't been solved. And it wasn't until he met that Swami.
Prabhavananda.
Prabhavananda or something, yeah. Yeah, Prabhavananda, okay. Didn't until he met him that just with like 10 classes or so, everyone was almost identical. Chalmers said he had 3 or 4 classes. But that's all. They had everything that he needed. And that's when that pramana functioned. And that's when Swamiji really knew. So in one way, he had what you call Swami Chinmayananda was his mula guru. Since where that shraddha took place, that heart bonding took place with Swami Chinmayananda. But Chinmayananda himself sent him out, you know, to get a little more. And that's where Swamiji discovered the Vedanta, the Upanishads as a pramana, as a means of knowledge and as a certain teaching tradition. And it was through that Prabhavananda that he got that. And then he went up to Rishikesh at some point and studied the whole Brahma Sutras with Tarananda. And so all of that's why if you go to India, in the lecture hall there at Anakati, there's a picture of Shankaracharya and then Swami Chinmayananda, Swami Prabhuananda or whatever. I don't know why I can miss.
Prabhu, right?
Yeah, Prabhu and Ananda. Prabhavananda. And then also Swami Talananda. Their pictures are there.
The one with the Giru Mamananda or something, the one with the square hat.
Who is that?
Tarananda.
Oh, that's Tarananda. Yeah, that's Tarananda with the square hat, yeah. That's the who Swamiji studied with in Rishikesh. We all got a chance to meet him. Actually, yeah.
Wow.
He was quite old, but he came to Rishikesh. And he talked in Hindi, I believe. I think it was in Hindi, and Swamiji translated. In Hindi, and Swamiji translated.
Yeah.
It was really nice. Anyway, just to fill you in all of these. It's important, though, to understand the tradition. And
are they all his gurus? Does he call them all his gurus? Or is just one of those people?
He'll say that all. He won't say one where. He'll say all his teachers. But I think, really, the one who really used the... And not even Tarananda. The one who used the Vedas as a pramana, the Upanishads as a pramana, with Prabhavananda. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But where Swami Chinmayananda was his first teacher, and that's where all that shraddha and devotion was. So that never changed. Inspirational. Mm-hmm. And he did get something from him, but he got his clarity from this, the middle one. He said until that time, he meditated so much, that his hair fell out. Lost all his hair. Because he was trying to achieve it, you know. He was trying to gain the knowledge that he had heard. And that's not how it works, you know. And so, anyway, finally understood and everything was fine. When he understood just these 3 classes, it's like he already knew all of the Upanishads, all of the Bhashas. He had this incredible memory. He had the Bhagavad Gita backwards and forwards he used to chant. Mm. So he had this tremendous medha shakti, incredible power of memory. But there wasn't the clarity. And then when he heard the pramana, that means of knowledge being properly wielded, everything just fell into place. Like he saw so clearly. So that was beautiful. Anyway. So now it says here, the one who was able to manifest that, make that self known to the devotees, to the students, he who does that, how does he do it? And now this is Dakshinamurti, through this Chinmudra. This is this symbol. So if you've seen like Dakshinamurti, the symbol of Dakshinamurti, like in the temple, the common way is that he has his foot down, and under his foot is this little fellow. It's the Ahankara that he's got his foot sitting on. And that guy is actually just sitting there like this. It's kind of a relief to get rid of the Ahankara. But he's got him under his foot. And then I think he has this Shanti blessing. Doesn't he have like this and then like this? Or like this? Mm-hmm. Yes, like this. It's a, like a welcoming, you know, peace and welcoming. And then this is the mudra. Actually, we talked about this a little bit before. But remember, he's surrounded by rishis. All of the rishis, they're all very, very studied people. So he's surrounded by these exalted elders who are rishis. And he's just sitting there like this, you know, that half smile that we talked about and the eyes gently closed and like this. So he's in just being with himself with this mudra. Okay? So they're sitting there with him. He is totally with himself, this mudra, which means this body mindset. There's different ways of looking at this mudra, but this is a simple and nice one. This body mind sense organs, this is the ahankara, this is Brahman. And so this means now I am Brahman. This ahankara that usually identifies the self with the body, mind, sense organs, you know, like Brahman's over here, and here I am. But when you have like this, and then he's totally with himself in meditation, then that becomes a teaching for these rishis who are already Brahmanishtas. They are Brahmanishtas, and they're sitting in front of the Lord who's giving this mudra, you know, with the whole posture, you know, and that speaks, that says everything that needs to be said with this mudra, especially for them. So we say sometimes teach. I think I've done here a meditation like that where you know, the soft eyelids, the gentle smile. Those are all, if you look at a murti in a temple, it's very, very finely detailed in the Shastra about exactly what that face is supposed to look at, like how far the eyes are apart, how far the nose is down, how big is the smile. All of these things are described, even down to the measurements. And so you see that expression is a symbol. It's a symbol of the self. It's a visual symbol of the self. And so if you take on for your own body that symbol, the symbol actually invokes your own presence. Even it's enough just to do it with the face. Relaxing the face, having that very gentle smile, the tongue is relaxed, the eyelids are closed without any wrinkles. You get a very gentle smile on the face. And that expression evokes, you know, the nature of yourself. So it's something to kind of play with and work with. Just like a frowning, you know, invokes a different type. You know, looking at doubt, it evokes those feelings. So they've done studies on this, not in psychology. Mm-hmm. So they can identify all of these facial movements that are not really conscious. But once you become conscious, if you're conscious of them, you can evoke them. But if you're not conscious of them, they just naturally take place in the body and in the mind when those feelings are there. So say you invoke the very feelings that is there in the murti, in the temple. You just kind of copy that look and that feeling and that pose and just be with that. And then if you're gaining knowledge and have knowledge, then it becomes very powerful. But for the Brahmanishtas that were sitting around Dakshinamurti, to have that, or that to take on that, that taking on that, seeing that symbol will evoke in them their own self. That Chin Mudra. Makes sense? So, Tasmai Shri Guru Murtiye Nama Idam Shri Dakshina Murtiye Om Tat Sat. Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavasishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha. Harihi Om. Om.